Welcome to the Athenaeum Review podcast, and we're here with Dr. Mark Rosman, who is Distinguished Professor and Pat M. Glaser Chair in Jewish Studies at Indiana University, a distinguished scholar and author of many books and articles and recipient of many awards. To mention only some of his most recent books, they include A Past in Hiding, Memory and Survival in Nazi Germany, Lives Reclaimed, A Story of Rescue and Resistance in Nazi Germany, and The Villa, The Lake, The Meeting, The Wannsee Conference, and The Final Solution. Thank you very much for being with us this morning.
My pleasure.
In your book, Lives Reclaimed, where you tell the story of this group, the Bund, a kind of association of people in Essen, in this area in the Ruhr in West Germany, who are devoted to socialist living or better living, incorporating both Marxist ideas of social justice and Kantian ideas of ethical life and decision making. You explore the way that this group was able to effectively help a number of Jewish people and even rescue and save several Jewish people during the Nazi years and the Holocaust in a way that that so many others were unable to do. And the thing in your lecture yesterday, which really struck me, was this sense that in opposition to the focus on a kind of heroic individual, a kind of individual heroic act, or an extremely altruistic kind of personality, that there was this, the way that this network, this group of people, many of whom individually may not have been heroes or unusually good people, but collectively as a group of people, they were able to do these great things. And maybe it's being in the kind of very individualistic culture of the United States, or this very individualistic mindset that seems to be part of the world we live in now. But I guess I wanted to ask you how it is that people get drawn into groups like this, and how a group like the Bund is able to kind of effectively move people and kind of encourage people to do these things. I mean, how you get from a sort of being just an individual person in mass society to being part of this very powerful and effective group.
Yes, thank you. And that's a great question. I mean, I think in Weimar Germany, Weimar Germany was a full of small groups. Yeah. I mean, it was a society. So this is the society, the German society that emerged after the First World War, right, until it was replaced by the Nazis. And it was full of groups. Lots of them were just ordinary leagues and clubs, and every political grouping then had its own cycling organization, and it had its right, soccer club, and there were garden clubs, and there were shooting clubs. There was every kind of club. But then on top of that, I think amongst younger people, there was a strong sense, and of course this was reinforced by the collapse of the old empire, by the fact that Germany had been defeated in the First World War, a sense that something had really gone wrong in German society, and the way people responded to that sense of what had gone wrong was very different. Some went very nationalist and were drawn towards the Nazis, some go towards socialism, like the group that I'm talking about. But there were a whole variety of these groups, and for the young people, part of the new sort of ethos of the time was that these would be like an alternative family, very tight-knit, right, often grouped around a charismatic leading figure, but bound very tightly to one another. So that was definitely in the zeitgeist of the time.
Right. What you last mentioned, the kind of structure with the leader and the charisma and so forth, I believe you... you also mentioned that after 1945, after the end of the Nazi regime and the war, that this group actually declined somewhat, or that the younger generation was apparently less was suspicious of belonging to such groups. And I was curious whether did that, has that kind of lasted to the present, or are there, is there any such legacy of groups continuing, or did they just sort of dissipate after? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, I mean, a lot of these groups disappear once the Nazis come to power, or they get absorbed into the Nazi movement. And in fact, one of the things that gave the Nazis their vigor and their strength was that they actually also drew on this youth movement tradition. So there they have their charismatic leader, Hitler, and they have their tightly knit group around him. And of course, they also have the Hitler Youth Movement, which in many ways is structured at least partly like other youth movements, in the sense that the leaders are themselves young people, so it's youth led by youth. So in that sense, the Nazis are drawn on that. So after 1945, the tragedy for my little group was that their whole style of operating had sort of been compromised by the Nazis.
Right.
And particularly youngsters who'd been in the army and now were coming back and looking for something new, they didn't want to find themselves at the feet of a much older charismatic figure. They didn't want to bind themselves into a group like the thing that they just found out that they'd been so enthused by, and now they realize it's been totally disastrously wrong. And so the Bund, this little group that I was looking at, the tragedy was they had opposed the Nazis, they'd really achieved something, and yet their whole style is compromised, because actually it doesn't look in its style so different from what had been discredited. So yes, now that's a very striking, and that mixture of close-knitness, but also the real authority of the leader. So it's in some ways democratic, because it's outside the existing structures and it's liberating in that sense, but it's also quite authoritarian, at least in the sense of the followers' willingness to accept the leadership of the critical personality. That does not return. I mean, there are other alternative movements. There are groups that emerged later in the 60s and 70s in Germany, and Germany still has lots of registered associations and clubs and gardeners and all that. But that tight-knit sense and following the leader in that way, that doesn't... unless you're in the national football team, that I would say does not return, because the Nazis really destroy the faith and the belief in that kind of a culture of leadership.
I see. Yeah. One of the other things that was so striking to me about the story that you have told was the way that these actions, which may be in one sense small, I'm referring to bringing flowers to the these people whose home was attacked, the Heinemann household, or sending packages to those in camps, and letting them know that they had not been forgotten, that there were people out there who were concerned. I guess until you described this, I would have said, well, these actions are so small. What can such small things do against the enormity of this? But it sounds like that sense of simply being affirmed in one's common humanity and affirming the social human bond between people was incredibly encouraging for those who were on the receiving end.
Absolutely. But I mean, I think what you said at the beginning is not wrong, because the group itself described its actions after the war. The German phrase is drops on a hot stone.
We would say
drops in the ocean.
Yeah.
And I mean, in terms of the overall outcome of what happened to German Jewry, what they do is infinitesimal. And it's a tiny fraction of German Jews who survive. So in that sense, I think what one always has a different perspective, because what it takes for a group to do anything in this regime is enormous, and what it achieves with enormous effort is tiny.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that I was trying to recover was that they themselves were not unaware of that discrepancy, that it was costing them a lot of courage and effort and risk to achieve something that was almost invisible, and yeah. how many people they weren't helping. And I didn't include this in the lecture, but I finished in the lecture with just a sort of uplifting note, the example of someone who writes from a displaced person camp. She'd gone to the ghetto in Theresienstadt, she'd survived it, and after the war in this camp in Bavaria, she writes to one of the members of the group to thank her for the parcel and says what an inestimable value they were, and the spiritual value, and you've not forgotten, and also the food, because there were some points where they were really starving and these little things that actually reached them in the parcel, that's the amazing thing, yeah. Were really worth something. So that's a sign of the difference that you can make. What I didn't say in the lecture is that this woman, Isa Hermann, soon after that committed suicide. Because for all that she had been assisted and helped, there was something about the burden of what she'd gone through that she just couldn't live with. And yeah. I know her father had died in Theresienstadt. Her mother survived but died soon after of ill health. And obviously there are things that she'd gone through that she just couldn't live with. So even there was someone where the group had made a palpable difference, yeah. it wasn't enough. For that person after the war. I mean, I don't blame the group for that. Obviously, nobody would. Yeah. But the fact is, you've always got to have two different perspectives. What did it cost to do anything? And what did that mean on the one hand? And what was their impact on the other?
Yeah. Something else that I found quite striking about this group was, in addition to the adult education and teaching and so forth, the role of or the importance of physical movement or gymnastics and this sort of thing, which I thought, well, you know, maybe to those of us like myself who spend all the time in the library and don't join these kind of groups, it seems, well, what does that have to do with this? But then I thought, well, in terms of kind of bonding a group together, nowadays in China, one of the biggest groups that I guess is seen as a threat to the regime is the Falun Gong. You know, they do this kind of body movement and exercise. And even in this country, I was reading an article about how the local CrossFit gyms are almost, cult is probably too strong a word, but the sense of devotion and commitment that people have to their CrossFit group is quite intense. And I realized, well, of course, like if you are physically engaged with your body, not just with your mind, but you're doing things that must really bond these people together. I mean, is that how it works?
It's a brilliant comment, and it actually makes me laugh, because one of the so just a little background for people who don't know the group, that the co-founder of this group, which emerged in the 20s as a sort of political outfit of the kind you describe, not at that point preparing for the Nazis at all and had to adapt to the Nazis, but the co-founder had been trained in Eurythmics as a child, which at that point was not a group headed by Anna Lennox, but by the movement. And she developed her own system of gymnastics, and the school that she created exists till today. Many of the people who come into the group encountered it through initially doing gymnastics training through her, and then sort of were introduced to larger activities. And actually, quite strikingly, some even come to it like that in the 30s. In the Nazi years, it was very hard to get new recruits in the Nazi years because you have to be so careful. But this was a way.
Right.
But one of them I interviewed, so I managed to interview some members of the group still. They were sort of average age 90, but still.
Yeah.
And she described this process. And she said, well, you know, I was learning this method with Dora, and I found that, you know, one had to commit to it with your whole body and so on. And then I realized, you know, that I had to commit myself also to against the regime. And looked at me, you know, and I thought, what? What just happened? So it was exactly the same. And I thought, how on earth is there a connection between physical exercise, yeah, and being anti-Nazi. And it's interesting, you know, you mentioned Falun Gong, because obviously Falun Gong's movements and so on are actually not so different from other movements that people who are supportive of the right. communists are also doing. I mean, there's part of all sorts of Chinese traditions of certain kinds of martial arts, physical exercises and so on. And so you do ask yourself, is there some kind of physical movement that's different and has one political meaning, and is there another kind that's different and has another? And I'm not sure, but I do think that Dora's approach to the body, which had a certain sense, it was trying to get back to naturalness. There was this strong sense of trying to rescue the body from the depredations of modern civilization, organic movement, fluid movement, trying to regain a sense of the meaning of each gesture. And this was so different from the regulated mass spectacles that the Nazis were putting on, and the and the performance orientated athleticism of the Hitler Youth movement. So I think perhaps there was not just a sense, okay, we're a group doing this together, but also we're connected to ourselves in a way that's different from the sort of regulated or reaching the ultimate way in which the regime is doing. That there's a sort of naturalness, it has an integrity to it that's different from what's around us. So I think it might have certainly felt to them like it had a meaning that was different from the world around them.
That's extremely interesting to me, as from having studied art history and visual studies. Of course, one of the kind of touch points of this history, we learn about Leni Riefenstahl's films and this, the image of the visual image of the masses there, and somewhat earlier, I think in many art history courses on this period, one often reads Siegfried Krakauer talking, I mean, this is a bit earlier, but talking about the mass and the kind of mechanized body and so forth. And so what you just described, this contrast of the natural, is very interesting, I think. But I wanted to ask about on one of your earlier books about the Wannsee conference and the history of this event. In terms of history, and this is according to my understanding, there's one copy of this protocol that survived, and I had to wonder, well, what if, I mean, these kind of contingencies of history, I mean, if that one, you know, on the one hand, if that one document had not survived, what would we know, or what would we not know? And then on the other hand, you know, this question of how these the members who met at this meeting were sort of not the top highest level. Must there have been meetings at the highest level for which we simply don't have documents? And if we had one document like that, we would understand it would be different. And I just, as a historian, this kind of contingency, you know, there's these thousands or millions of documents, and yet whether this one survives or doesn't has such an effect. I just wanted to ask kind of about your method and how you approach these kind of questions.
Mm-hmm. No, it's a great question. So the Wannsee Conference took place on January the 20th, 1942. And it's often seen it's a little meeting, as you're saying, of the sort of higher level civil servants. So it's the sort of top level below the ministerial level, the sort of what in the US would be, I think, the permanent secretary or the undersecretary. And it's often seen as the moment when the final solution was decided upon. Certainly it's a meeting where that's fairly explicit that murder is the policy, and it's clearly sketching out a general plan, although that general plan doesn't quite match with what then later happened. What would have happened if we hadn't found that document? In some ways, we wouldn't have made a mistake that we made, which is to think that this meeting was the meeting where it was decided on. So the document is very revealing, but what it's revealing of is it gives us a window on a process of decision making that had reached a certain point. But in fact, exactly what the function of this particular meeting was is quite challenging to decide, because it clearly wasn't the moment where certain things could be decided on, because that had to be at the level of Hitler, Himmler, and so on. And some of the things that are laid out there aren't what happened. And some of the things that that seem to be being resolved, particularly about what you should do with mixed race Jews and Jews in mixed marriage, aren't then what happened, because there are follow-up meetings and some of the proposals here are blocked. So what exactly is the significance of this meeting? So in that sense, the fact that the document was found, and also some things that had been in other places that suggested that there was an important high-level meeting taking place, which we knew about before we even knew this, found the document. The document wasn't found until 1947.
Yeah.
All suggested that this was key.
Yeah.
And then the document was there. And so, but in fact, it's taken historians decades to undo that and sort of identify, well, this is what we're learning. So yes, it's right. Revealing, but at the same time, it's hard to interpret. And that and so you're right. There's this sort of double history. There's the history that we're trying to recover, but then there's also this history of finding documents,
right.
and the way in which the Nazi period has been understood lies in part in the history in which documents have been found,
yeah.
or documents have been paid attention to, because sometimes they're documents that have been there for a long time. And so, for example, the trial records that Christopher Browning used for his
right.
Ordinary Men, and they'd been around for quite a while, but
right.
historians had a look at them, or many hadn't, and suddenly he made clear what you could get out of these German trial records from the 60s and 70s that that let us shine a light on individual participation.
It's very valuable, you know, for those of us who are interested in modern history. You know, it's easy to kind of look back on ancient history and say, well, yes, we only have these few fragments, and you have to kind of look at this one thing and imagine the whole world around it. But it's very useful reminder, as you point out, that of the need to be conscious of how we select and interpret these things.
Well, we have a treble problem here.
Yeah.
One is Hitler didn't write stuff down, and he particularly didn't write stuff down on this this matter, the matter of moving towards the murder of the Jews. So at the very top, where the key decisions are taken, there's a gap. So that's one.
Yeah.
The second thing is that in his early rhetoric, Hitler, which we have recorded, he is extraordinarily violent in his language, which could mean anything. When it comes, as we move towards the actual genocide, the terms become more euphemistic.
Yeah.
So the violent language is a little bit removed from the decisions, and the language that's closer that we have is often more euphemistic. So the difficulty is interpreting when is him talking about eradicating the bacillus. Does
right.
that mean he's actually thinking about genocide in the 20s?
Yeah.
Or is that just the rhetoric?
Yeah.
And when they're talking about evacuating the Jews in 1942, well, does that mean they're too thinking of deportations? Or is that actually they're thinking murder? So the language of what we have is hard to interpret it. And then I think the third thing is, you know, if we were talking about planning, building of a city,
right.
Or rejudging the economy, we just wouldn't pass the stuff that precisely. We just
right.
wouldn't. We just assume, okay, they decided it. But where you've got something so monstrous,
yeah.
and where you're so crossing the thresholds of what we thought human beings were capable of,
yeah.
you kind of want to have an even more precise sense of it. Well, how on earth
yeah.
did they get there? And so that. So that even if you have, you know, in other words, what I'm saying is the documentary chain that we have for many ordinary things would be twice as much as you'd need to write the perfect
right.
history.
Right.
But here you want to know exactly how it
yes,
was designed,
yes.
because the cross taking us across this threshold is so much harder to explain.
Yes. This is the Athenaeum Review podcast, And our guest today is Mark Roseman, author of Lives Reclaimed, a story of rescue and resistance in Nazi Germany.